News, I'm Tommy McNeil. After the first case of Ebola virus was confirmed in a Congolese city of Goma, the World Health Organization warned that the outbreak of Democratic Republic of Congo might be considered an international health emergency. The WHO says more than 1,650 people have died in the current outbreak in eastern DRC, while about 12 new cases are reported every day. Over the weekend, unidentified attackers killed two Ebola health workers in eastern Congo in the latest in a string of assaults that have hobbled efforts to contain the outbreak. The workers had been getting death threats since December. Gunmen believed to be in local militias have made a string of attacks on Ebola clinics in recent months, driving out the patients and destroying the buildings. The UN Health Agency's chief, Tedros, said that he would reconvene the WHO's emergency committee to decide if the outbreak now constitutes an international health emergency.
Both of these events encapsulate the challenges we continue to face on a daily basis in DRC. Just when we start to get control of the virus in one area, it appears in another. And violence and insecurity continue to undermine the response. We're dealing with one of the world's most dangerous viruses in one of the world's most dangerous areas.
That is UN Health Agency's Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. Nationwide raids aimed at rounding up 2,000 immigrants in the country illegally got off to a low-key start Sunday and targeted cities, churches, and lawyers were standing by to offer sanctuary and advice. New York City Council member Carlos Menchaca said that the Know Your Right flyer distribution effort paid off in his Sunset Park, Brooklyn district. This is VOA News.
James Alex Fields has already been sentenced to life in prison on federal hate crimes charges. One of the protesters in the crowd that day in Charlottesville 2 years ago was killed. Heather Heyer. Susan Bro is her mother.
The situation started years ago, didn't end today, but I feel like he's at least in the hands of justice.
Constance Young was injured in Charlottesville. She wishes there was more force behind the prosecution.
White supremacists like James Fields are much more of a threat to me and people like me than ISIS or any foreign terrorists. Yet Mr. Fields was not prosecuted as a terrorist because our nation continues to minimize the brutality of white supremacy.
President Trump sparked controversy at the time when he blamed the violence at the rally on both sides. I'm Ed Donahue.
This is all, of course, after an avowed white supremacist was sentenced to 419 years on state charges for deliberately driving his car into anti-racism protesters during a white nationalist rally in Virginia in 2017. Four Democratic Party members of the U.S. Congress have appeared together before reporters in a collective and blistering show of force to go up against President Donald Trump's social media and verbal volleys against them. Mr. Trump set off a firestorm of controversy Sunday by tweeting that the lawmakers should go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, even though three of the four were born in the United States. The congresswomen had plenty to say in return. We get more from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Massachusetts Democrat Ayanna Pressley says President Trump's xenophobia and bigotry is
a disruptive distraction from the issues of care, concern, and consequence.
Minnesota's Ilhan Omar, the only one not born in the U.S., says the president should be impeached.
Report on the bile of garbage that comes out of his mouth, or we can hold him accountable to his crimes.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says going back to her country means
the great borough of the Bronx.
Most congressional Republicans have been silent about the controversy, but South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who is black, says the personal and racial attacks are unacceptable. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Asked on Monday whether his comments were racist, Mr. Trump told White House reporters not at all. India's space agency says a technical snag forced it to call off the launch of an unmanned probe to the moon's south pole. Mission 2 was aborted less than an hour before it liftoff Monday. There's no new launch date set yet. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, July the 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. The head of the World Health Organization warns that the spread of Ebola to a large city in the eastern DRC could have dire consequences.
The identification of the case in Goma could potentially be a game changer in this epidemic.
That is the WHO Director General, Mr. Tedros Ghebreyesus. And former South African President Jacob Zuma told a corruption inquiry that his enemies had plotted to bring him down. And analysts say that last week's quadrupartite summit in Angola that brought together the presidents of Rwanda and Uganda was a positive step in working towards a resolution of tensions between the two neighboring countries. And in Kenya, the Council of Governors and Senators marched to the Supreme Court to file a petition to stop the National Assembly from sharing revenue allocated for county government.
The council sought judicial intervention severally to declare some of the laws unconstitutional since the weekend devolution.
That is Mr. Wycliffe Oparanya, chair of the Kenya's Council of Governors. Stay tuned. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. We start off in the DRC, where the head of the World Health Organization warns that the spread of Ebola to the eastern city of Goma could have dire consequences. Speaking at a high-level meeting, the World Health Organization chief examined current efforts to contain the growing Ebola epidemic in the DRC and how to contain it from spreading to neighboring countries.
The identification of the case in Goma could potentially be a game changer in this epidemic. Goma is a city of 2 million people near the border with Rwanda and is a gateway to the region and the world. We're confident in the measures we're put in place and hope that we will see no further transmission of Ebola in Goma.
That is World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. The Ebola outbreak in Congo's conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces is the second largest after the historic 2014 epidemic that killed 11,300 people in West Africa. And as the first anniversary of the DRC epidemic draws near, the WHO reports that nearly 2,500 people have been infected with the virus and 1,665 people have so far died. The WHO warns that there is a high risk of geographical spread of Ebola within the DRC and to neighboring countries. In Uganda, health officials said that they are intensifying measures to control the spread of the virus in the country. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
Emmanuel Aineviona, the spokesperson of Uganda's Ministry of Health, says Uganda has not had any case of the deadly Ebola virus in about a month. But after the virus was confirmed in Goma of neighboring DR Congo, Aineviona says health officials in the country are now worried the disease could easily spread in Uganda.
We can say Uganda has successfully interrupted transmission of the Ebola virus disease. But we are well aware that the cases in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is in the neighboring, are still escalating. This may put us on high alert, so we continue to do cross-border surveillance. We remain screening all passengers coming into Uganda through all the points of entries and also the international airport Entebbe.
Dr. Jonas Tegan Odamariam, the head of World Health Organization in Uganda, agrees.
Every case which is reported in DRC is of concern to the neighboring country, not only Uganda, but to all countries, because unless we control it in DRC, we will continue facing the challenge. And you very well know that the population migration between DRC and Uganda is a lot. including through border towns like Kisoro, Arua, or Kasese.
At least 10,000 Congolese cross the DR Congo border into Uganda weekly to do business. Ebola hemorrhagic fever, or simply Ebola, is a viral disease of humans and other primates caused by Ebola virus. There is no cure or specific treatment that is currently approved, but treatment is primarily supportive in nature. Oda Mariam says insecurity in DR Congo and ignorance hamper efforts to fight the disease.
Globally, the biggest challenge we have is controlling it in DRC because of the non-public health issues, that is peace and security and building community trust.
Efforts to contain the disease in the DR Congo have been hampered by violent attacks on health workers and treatment centers. The Health Ministry of DR Congo said Monday two community health workers engaged in Ebola prevention were killed in the eastern North Kivu province. WHO and the government of Uganda have vaccinated more than 6,000 people, mainly health workers, as the one way to prevent the spread of the disease. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. In Kenya, the Council of Governors and Senators yesterday marched to the Supreme Court to file a petition to stop the National Assembly from sharing revenue allocated for county government. The Senate and National Assembly have disagreed on a bill which allocates funds between the two levels of government. And for more on this, Maureen Ojambo reports from Nairobi.
Marched in the streets of Nairobi, led by the chair of the Council of Governors Weekly for Paranya, a march that moved the governors to the Supreme Court following a row with the national government over sharing revenue that threatened to paralyze services in devolved units. Speaking during the march, Mr. Paranya says most of the services at the county level are stalled for lack of funds.
Over the last 6 years, we have witnessed onslaught on devolution. In the first term of county government, we saw devolution being undermined through formulation and enactment of centralist policies and laws. The council sought judicial intervention severally to declare some of the laws unconstitutional since they weakened devolution.
Earlier, members of the mediation committee formed by the Speaker of the National Assembly and that of the Senate to develop a consensus over the dispute on the division of revenue bill 2019 failed, putting the funds due to counties in danger. Oparanya, however, says they are not relenting until the county funds are released.
The Senate moved to 327 billion Kenya shillings. With the two different positions of the National Assembly and the Senate, the negotiation collapsed. Today marks the third week into the new financial year 2019-2020 without an agreement on this stalemate. Devolved governance is being attacked by denying county governments their imaginated resources.
Supporting the governors, the senators across all the counties joined the march, blaming the National Assembly after they disagreed on the bill which allocates funds between the two levels of government. Sia Senator, who is also the Senate Minority Leader, James Orengo, said that the aim of the petition is not to fight the National Assembly.
Some years ago, seeing something like this happen shows quite clearly that there's a level of impunity. And I think this should not be seen as a sibling rivalry between the Senate and the National Assembly, or be seen as a struggle between the national executive and the counties. It should be seen as a fundamental constitutional question.
The governors are accusing the national government of killing devolution. Makueni Governor Kivutha Kibwana says without budgets, counties cannot run efficiently.
The county's money, the DORA law, if it is not passed, then there is no money allocated to the counties so that they can do budgets. And even if they purport to pass any budgets, those are not legal budgets.
The two sides have different figures for what is due for the counties. The National Assembly has revised its earlier position and proposed that counties get 316 billion Kenya shillings, and the Senate has protested and they insist that the law must be respected and counties allowed to get their due share. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
In Malawi, the Electoral Commission has warned the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, MCP, that it will be held responsible for attacks on its employees. The commission is worried that statements vilifying employees of the Electoral Commission would encourage supporters of the party to attack officials of the body. The MCP is joined by other opposition parties, including the United Transformation Party, UTM, to legally challenge the outcome of the May 21st general election. The parties argue that the polls were fraught with voter irregularities and rigging. They demand the resignation of Dr. Justice Jen Ansah, chairperson of the Electoral Commission. They also say that Malawians no longer have confidence in the ability of the commission to administer transparent and credible future elections. Meanwhile, an official of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, has called for dialogue with Lazarus Chakwera, presidential candidate for the MCP, and former Vice President Dr. Saulos Chilima, leader of the opposition, UTM, in an effort to ease rising political tension in the Southern African country. But the MCP says that although it welcomes dialogue, the call is misplaced. For the latest political development, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Maurice Montali, spokesperson for the Malawian main opposition party, MCP.
Those remarks are baseless and misplaced in their entirety, because in the first place, let Malawi Electoral Commission ask themselves as to why there is this tension in this country. Malawi Congress Party believes, and strongly so, that all this unrest is coming out of how they messed up the 21 May elections. So it is them that are to blame and not Malawi Congress Party. We issued a statement on behalf of Malawians stating that what MEC is doing is suspicious. And in fact, not just suspicious, they are acting contrary to what is on the ground and what is in the courts of law at the moment. Why are they going around collecting new signatures on new result sheets, dealing with the same presiding officers that were running the elections?
Some are saying your leaders are stoking the political fire. Your supporters are attacking staff or employees of the Malawi Electoral Commission, thereby putting their life in danger. Is this what your party is espousing to, particularly when you are challenging in court the outcome of the entire general election?
What we are saying, and emphatically so, is that they are the cause of all this. Let them blame nobody else but themselves. We are only calling upon the population of Malawi, the general public, to be vigilant. And to be vigilant is to be alert, because MEC is running the exercise very suspiciously. How should they be going about angering people even more by giving people cash and then coercing them to sign new documents altogether? In fact, to say the truth, Malawians are already angry, and they should rather not have entered into this exercise, even without having to inform all stakeholders. But they have chosen to do this on their own, calling the presiding officers, even talking to them at night, and giving them money. This is more than being suspicious.
Do you have proof of what you're saying? Because officials of the Malawi Electoral Commission have denied these allegations. And by the way, are you not challenging this in court if you already have the evidence?
And if we are all in the courts, why are they moving about suspiciously like this if everything else is in the court? So we cannot just sit and watch just because something is in court. Let each one of us then just stay quiet and wait upon what the court is going to say, because we have proof, yes, We have people who can testify in court having received money from these people. They will always deny anyway, but they know they messed up and they're trying to save their face, and that face is never going to be saved because we are going to be vigilant. We want to make sure that the people's rights are not infringed upon and the people's choice is respected.
That was Maurice Muntali, spokesperson for the Malawian main opposition party, MCP. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Thank you all of you for joining us this morning. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. We go to West Africa, where Nigeria recently joined other African countries in the landmark Free Trade Pact. President Muhammadu Buhari signed the Continental Free Trade Agreement in Niger last week after previously holding out. The free trade agreement, which removes most tariff and other commercial barriers on the African continent, grew to 54 signatories, making it the world's largest free trade zone. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports on what the free trade agreement means for business in Nigeria.
The African Union estimates that implementing the African Continental Free Trade Area will lead to around 60% boost in intra-African trade by 2020. According to the African Development Bank, only 16% of international trade by African countries takes place between African countries. This is reflected in the challenges faced by small businesses in Nigeria.
One problem I have is taxes and duties when you buy from abroad. Custom duties are always a headache for us.
Jaye Palingo runs a cloth printing business in Nigeria. He prefers to source quality raw materials from abroad within Africa, but he says the cost of bringing them home has been too expensive and discouraging.
Last year, I was in Johannesburg to buy materials. The problem I faced was getting them down here and also the amount of money I had to pay for shipping. It was ridiculous.
But things will soon change for Jai's business. With Nigeria now signed up to the African Continental Free Trade Area, that's according to Professor Ndubuisi Nwokoma of the Department of Economics, University of Lagos.
It's easier for me to buy my raw materials from within the zone than going to buy from outside the zone. And that will affect him in the cost of those raw materials he needs to buy from those countries when this ACFTA comes into effect.
The ACFTA is expected to create a market of over 1 billion people with a GDP of approximately $2.6 trillion. Meanwhile, with Nigeria, Africa's biggest economy, now part of the continent's free trade agreement, Professor Nwokoma says the agreement puts Africa in a much stronger position to negotiate trade with the rest of the world.
When you are outside any grouping and you're a small country, you'll be struggling. It's just like Benin Republic going to negotiate with China. It's an unequal negotiation. Whatever they tell you, you say, you can't even say no. But if Africa as a market is just one market, it can negotiate better in the world economy. It's against Togo or Benin or Eritrea to negotiate with the U.S. The U.S. will tell you what they want to give you. Take it or leave it.
Trading under the African Continental Free Trade Area is expected to start in July 2020. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Analysts say that last week's quadripartite summit in Angola that brought together the presidents of Rwanda and Uganda was a positive step in working towards a resolution of tensions between the two neighboring countries. The meeting chaired by Angola's President João Lourenço agreed to, quote, prioritize the resolution of any dispute between their respective countries by peaceful means. From Kigali, Rwanda, Eugene Uwimana reports that there's agreement that Rwanda-Uganda tensions actually needed a third-party mediator.
Regional analysts say that a third-party mediator was necessary to help in the resolution of the tension between the two East African neighbors of Rwanda and Uganda. Previous meetings between President Museveni and Kagame failed to bear fruit as both sides continued to trade accusations and counter-accusations. Pascal Hura is a Rwandan political analyst.
Definitely it was needed, and actually when you have two people who are less likely to solve their issues directly between the direct talks between themselves, you need that third party. The behavior of a state, you see, in most cases goes with who is on top of the leadership in that country.
The quadripartite summit in Rwanda was the first meeting between President Paul Kagame and his Ugandan counterpart, President Yoweri Museveni, that involved other heads of state to discuss bilateral relations between the two countries. Earlier this year, Rwanda's President Paul Kagame publicly accused his Ugandan counterpart of failing to act on reports that his government was supporting rebels seeking to destabilize the country. Mr. Kagame said that he had personally discussed the issue with Uganda's Yoweri Museveni, but that their talks seemed to have hit a wall.
We have evidence, and I have discussed it with my counterpart in Uganda. There are meetings we had in Addis Ababa, have a summit. We met twice on 2 days during the summit, directly, we're talking. I have kept quiet about so many things, but tried to attend, you know, to them, pay attention, do my best, do this, and hoping that the best will come, and it doesn't come.
For Pascal Uhura, DRC's president is a neutral mediator who can bring President Kagame and Museveni back to the negotiating table.
Again, remember all the negative forces which Rwanda accuses Uganda of supporting are based in Eastern DRC. So it's a problem to DRC itself, but it's also a problem to Rwanda. You find that today we have Tshisekedi, who is somehow seen as a person or a president who is not linked to any of the two governments. The position where DRC sits itself gives DRC a better position to try to stand between the Kampala and Kigali.
Rwanda-Uganda tensions turn around accusations. Rwanda accuses Uganda to host dissidents who plan to destabilize the country. Uganda accuses Kigali to send soldiers to spy on Kampala. Each party dismisses others' allegations. Consequently, the two peoples keep on starving as trade ties were cut on borders. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma told a corruption inquiry on Monday that his enemies had plotted to bring him down, insisting that he had never broken the law with the business family at the center of an influence peddling scandal. The inquiry is looking into allegations that Zuma allowed cronies to plunder state resources and influence government appointments.
There has been a drive to remove me from the scene, a wish that I should disappear. This conspiracy against me has been stretched at all material times when there are things to be done or said.
That is former South African President Jacob Zuma defending himself yesterday at a commission of inquiry into corruption. And that's it for this Tuesday, the 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good day, Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, after months of violent protests in Sudan, a preliminary power-sharing agreement has been negotiated between the Forces for Democratic Change and the Transitional Military Council. Sudan in transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.